Hi everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We are in the beginning of June 2018, and we are continuing on the political theory of Lev Gumilev, what is essentially a philosophy of history. It's very easy to get lost in the details here and not see the broad picture. I think to summarize last week, and this man is of immense importance, and not just Russia, but Eurasia in general, and so he's of global significance, that an ethnic group is a part of the natural order. In fact, the ethnic group is something that skirts both biology and the social realm. The is-ought distinction is purely a decadent Western creation of David Hume and having nothing to do, really, with reality. Natural law is natural law. And in this case, he's trying to pinpoint how an ethnic group comes into existence, what it's related to, and why it should matter. And essentially, you're talking about a group of people, a small group of people, who are confronted with an alien environment, who then have to adjust the way that they live and think to eke out a living, not just the environment naturally, but their neighbors. And in these structures of survival, as I've termed them that many years ago, long before actually I read Gumilev, but structures of survival are these things that they're relics of adaptation. Is another way to put it. How a group of people come to survive. You take a family, to say, you know, your average, you know, alien nuclear family in America, and this family has been through a lot. They've, let's say they have a sick child, let's say that they have terrible, you know, one of them has terrible in-laws, they're going through financial difficulty, they've been robbed, you know, and of course at the same time they've had many positive things happen to them. Because they've been able to hang together, they've weathered these storms, and they recognize that. But the very nature of, and the identity of this family, has been etched in the suffering that those events have engendered. They've had to adapt. They have to deal with the fact that they've gone through this, and it's not fair, but they have no choice in the matter. But they know that hanging together and sacrificing for one another is in fact, you know, self-interested. And the concept of self-interest is purely a Western, industrial chimera. It can't exist because the individual is not even a social unit of any significance. It's not social by definition. But the individual by himself can't function for 2 seconds. The human baby is totally helpless. It needs a mother and a father. It needs a nuclear family, and just as importantly, the extended family and the community within which the extended family can operate. Otherwise, you don't get individuals. When an individualist or egoist is justifying their point of view, point out that the very logic that they use, the language that they use, the universe of meaning that we all adhere to, none of it's of their making. These are all communal products. So they contradict themselves. In the very definition of individualism, it's its own negation. It's an absurdity. And we all know that the reality of the matter is that so-called individualism is really about destroying ethnic groups and nations, making people more pliable, destroying all other sources of loyalty other than capital and the state in one form or another. So you take any family that suffered like that, the individuals there, you know, define themselves as part of this family. They define themselves as having survived that, and their personality has this imprinted on them, and often they're very proud of that fact. This is the identity of these people. It is no different than with nations. You could even take an individual. Individuals grow and mature. They borrow from others. No one ever denies an individual because they take from others, because they're often dependent on others. Even individuals, when they define themselves, we pick and choose elements of our own personality that all of the attacks on nationalism, if you apply it to the individual, the family, will destroy that too. And there's nothing left. An individual functions, it could be, as Bosanquet would say, the individual is also a community. The individual is, as we learned with Hegel, is a product of natural development. It's a product of natural law. It's a product of social development and genetics and what Vernadsky would call the new sphere, energy and the constant interplay of things that we're not even aware of at any given moment. The tremendous complexity that can permit even a simple civilization to function. All of this before we can utter a word. So even an individual doesn't exist on that level because it's a community. An individual is a collection of things. Your mind is a collection of functional units. The national reality, the nation, the ethnic group, is defined in how its parts work together, weathering these kind of storms. I've actually had debates with university professors where they say that, when you have guilds and you have unions, you have so many other forms of things competing for your loyalty, the nation is just one of many. And I said, you don't understand. I said, in order for those to function, they all have to be speaking the same language and have the same concepts of fairness and a whole bunch of other things that you're not thinking about. This isn't just one collection out of many. It's the one that makes everything else function. Remember, when I say language, when the literature here says language, they're referring to any form of communication, things that we're conscious of and things that we're not. So you have a small ethnic group forming in the same way that I just described the family. You can just think of it that way. People have to learn to adapt. That adaptation becomes who they are. One of the things that makes an ethnic group what it is are challenges. The obvious one is an unfavorable climate, not just natural disasters, but the fact that some live in cold areas, some in tropical areas. And this is going to have a great degree of a great impact onto who they are. Another more obvious one is foreign attack. Mobilizing to fight a foreign invader, the very fact you use the word foreign, you're talking about a nation. There's us versus them. There's always us versus them. That's how it is. That's how the church is. That's how everything is. It's always us versus them. Excluding the other is what we do. And the other less obvious one is the decay of the older civilization. That the founding stock, we talked about the passionaries last time, this group of fanatics that through some kind of weird mutation, some short circuit in their thought process, puts the goods of the whole above their own welfare, and in fact, above their own desire for survival. This is how the human being goes way beyond cause and effect, because now it's willing to sacrifice itself rationally and freely for the sake of the nation. At any given moment, a nation can't function without this group. an ethnic group begins as this group of passionaries makes sense out of how this group has responded to disaster. They start writing, they start reflecting on what this means for us. This is how an ethnic group is made. This is how a family is made. This is how a person is made. This is simply how it is. These struggles make us what we are. And in nowhere is that more obvious than on the ethnic level. You ask someone who doesn't like nationalists, say, is imperialism bad? And they say yes. And you say, why? Well, it's because one ethnic group imposes its will on another. But wait a minute. If ethnic groups don't exist, then imperialism can't exist. There's no ethnic group to impose on. These are just individuals or economic units. So not only is imperialism not bad, but it doesn't exist. Imperialism is bad because it gets in the way of national development. And that's the only reason that imperialism is bad. The individual can't function. The family can't function without the national collective, the sense of self, the sense of being this very firm, homogenous sense of unity. Without it, not only do you have a decay, but you have unscrupulous people who know how to manipulate these divisions for their own purposes. Gumilev, at his highest level of theory, talks about the new sphere. Now, this is not exactly something that I don't have a scientific background, but this is an old Russian idea that all living beings, and in fact, well, I mean, all living beings are connected energetically. That there is this single, you know, there's a theological element to this too. There's a single presence of energy. And how it's distributed has everything to do with how we function. The thing that makes living matter interesting is that it is not entropic. It fights entropy. But this energy and where it goes, if it's used properly, if it's channeled properly, if it's wasted, creates not only the ethnic group, but the individual. I have an article on the Warden Post about the absurdity of capitalism and how wasteful it is. And you watch, just watch a football game and look at the dome. The ridiculous amount of labor, intellectual and otherwise, that goes into that. It's a complete waste. You know, these huge rock concerts and everything else, they suck down a huge amount of energy. This is the problem here. It's not being properly channeled. It's going to this, where the only growth industry is really in the entertainment. You have a single stock of energy that we can use. And part of the national idea is how this is channeled and is dissipated in our situation and in a lot of decaying situations. But the ethnos is dependent on how this energy is, and part of what the passionary does is do exactly this channeling. And it's necessary for any cooperation. In fact, it is the foundation for cooperation. And the matter that's used is, in fact, information. Not just words, but all forms of action, all forms of communication, and that's what he means by tradition. What creates the system is this strange outburst of energy. It may or may not come from a challenge or a shock to the system. That's not clear. It can. It doesn't have to. One of the worst things for any society is for a very negative shock to be imposed on it, and for there to be no reaction. I remember, I guess this must have been 2008, 2009. The banks had, you know, sucked down every bit of equity they could. They were absolutely irresponsible in how they bundled all of it with it, not just mortgages, but all loans. The rating agencies were on the take. They're working for the same people thanks to the destruction of the regulatory structure. The ratings agencies were under the same roof as the banks themselves and the investment houses themselves. They were living on debt that was based on debt. When that collapsed, banks were now in trouble. They had profited beyond belief. And then the doctrine of too big to fail, which really is just rubbing your nose in how powerless you are. That not only will they now exploit you, when a bank takes out a loan, when you take out a loan with a bank, your signature is worth quite a bit of money, which they can then trade. So if the coupon value is, say, $1,000, you have good credit, it's $900. They've already made that because they could go sell that bond now. So it's the same, a credit card, it's a debit card, as Mickey Paletta and so many others have pointed out. So they profit that way. Then, of course, you're paying back on this debit card. So now they're profiting twice. So why paying back on a loan, for example, a credit card, doesn't make sense. The value has already been sold. The credit card credit the bank has already cashed in on your signature. It's been sold a bunch of times before you have to pay it. So you're paying on what you've already paid. You know, a bank takes out a loan. I'm sorry, you take a loan out with a bank. The bank already profits because your signature is worth, depending on your credit rating, almost the coupon value, the value of the bond. And then you're paying on that. Then you're paying the interest. And if something happens and you can't pay anymore, then they'll take the asset. So in theory, a bank can profit 4 or 5 times over on one loan. I mean, when Mickey explained this to me, I know we're going off topic here a bit, but Mickey Paletta is in Pennsylvania. He explained this to me, and it took him 5 times. It still wouldn't penetrate. It was so simple. You know what a bond market is, right? When you sign a promissory note and a credit card, that bank now has an asset just slightly under the credit limit that they're giving you. Now, if you have bad credit, it's much less, but you've already paid maybe half the coupon value. That's what a bond market is. It's currency. Then you pay on that, so they profit twice, then interest, and then conceivably, they take the asset. And it took him 5 times for it to penetrate. It's a simple, stupid thing. And once you get it through your head, you realize how fraudulent it is. But they weren't finished there. There's yet another level of profit, and that is they were going to force the taxpayers to bail them out. It was about $1 trillion. And I distinctly remember this. I said to Willis Cardo, I said, if the American population takes this flying down, it's over. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Something so blatantly unjust. The average homeowner has been exploited at 4 or 5 different levels by the same bank. They may have even taken your house, and now you have to bail them out for it. And if there's no revolt, violent or otherwise, then it's over. It's a corpse. It's nothing. It's not something that can react anymore. This is a dead society. This is where the energy isn't not being channeled improperly. There's no energy at all. Anyway, but this energy, we're always making reference to it. We talk about the national will to do something. Something like, total war, 1941, the U.S. federal government with not a shred of constitutional authority took over the entire economy and ran it as a command economy like the Soviet Union for the sake of the war effort. This is one of the great products of the 20th century, is that the slaughter of other people was so overwhelming that they needed to take over every bit of productive capital for the sake of building greater weapons and making it easier to kill people. The concept of total war is the way that the state then forces this energy. Now, you have a relatively healthy society. Yes, the U.S. fought on the wrong side, of course. But taking that abstractly, it was a healthy society. People did their part. There were no draft riots. I mean, there were, that's not true. There were draft riots, but it was nothing like you had in Vietnam, where the energy was dissipated everywhere. You had a single, and the energy being properly channeled has everything to do with national unity. That's the connection. And that's the border between biology and social theory. So there's several levels here. The first, as we said before, is the super ethnos. And this is, I think, is all we mean by civilization. Danilevsky or Dugin, even Spengler, what they mean by a civilization. Not a qualitative distinction. Not a qualitative distinction. But the simple notion of this, the largest possible unit under all humanity. The concept of all humanity is a nonsense word. There is no such thing. There is no entity that corresponds to. It's an imaginary idea. The same people who will condemn nationalists for believing this imaginary identity will talk about the values of humanity. That exists. That absurd abstraction exists. But national culture does not. The civilization is best defined as where you have ethnic groups that are grouped together by geography and general certain similarities. So the Arabic world, Sub-Saharan Africa, the Slavic world, Western Europe. You know, Huntington's division, which is a legitimate one. I mean, you know, Danilevsky had a similar version. These aren't nations. These are greater than nations. They're civilizations. But they're extremely large and very broad. In fact, there's so much diversity underneath them, it becomes very arbitrary. There's more differences within than among. So to have something more to sink your teeth into, you have just underneath that the units of the civilization or the ethnic group. This is really the mover of history in a secular way, in my view and in Gumilev's view. But beneath that, these are groups that have a certain autonomy, culturally speaking. I don't mean that in a political sense. But they're groups of people like Letts in northern Finland, certain some divisions of any group that is probably too small to function on their own. And in fact, they're brought to life because they're a part of something larger. But they're not quite at a level of independent nationhood. And this is the sub-ethnos. And in fact, their existence really is in being this marginal part of an ethnic group. Underneath that is what makes it up. That's a convixia. Clans, the very extended family, communities bound together by certain moral connections. Underneath that is really the lowest level that Gumilev talks about, and that's a consortia. That's informal units. We're talking about things like universities or bridge clubs. Now, these things aren't to be made fun of. You know, the great book, Bowling Alone, which everyone who goes to grad school in political science has to read, that these consortia are absolutely essential to the function of any society. And when they decline, it's a sign of a decay of trust. So the concept of bowling alone means that something like bowling leagues, as they're becoming rarer and rarer, that means you don't have the drive, you don't have the energy to form these things anymore. It's easier to go and do it yourself. But it's these consortia, it's these smaller informal groups that build the trust that then go and create the nation. You can't have the nation without it. the concept of representation in the time the Constitution was written, of course, bears no resemblance to what it is today. I think I said this before, but you had a group of small landowners, very well armed, educated, especially in Greek and Latin. Not, you know, these aren't scholars, but they're not idiots either. They're craftsmen, they're landowners, you know, they own the means of production. That's not owned by someone else. In other words, they're completely independent. Dependent people you can't trust because their opinions come from who they're dependent on, or as a reaction of being dependent. Free people, in Jefferson's sense of the term. They get together informally and send someone to Congress. The significance here is that they know the guy. They can't get away with anything. And where the anti-federalists said, you know, it's impossible to have a representation of 20,000 people. Now you have several million people. So representation is absurd. That's where both the consortia and the convictia are extremely important. Without these units, the convictia is significant because often these are blood related. These are powerful families. Sometimes we call them, you know, in America, any you know, strong families are often considered crime families, which is often nonsense. But we have groups like the Kennedys, that fit this in our destroyed, you know, sick way. You know, the America, this really can't be applied to the U.S. because nothing is legitimate in the U.S., not just the government, but in the way of life. So that's the foundation. This is where we are with building the idea of the ethnic group, and that this is a purely natural phenomenon. Only when this is understood, then you can start talking about things like language and race and everything else. Because that stuff has to have something to adhere to. It doesn't exist on its own. All right, now let's switch gears here for a minute. When I wrote my first book, The Third Rome, I was a young guy. I was 29 years old, and I made a few mistakes, believe it or not. And one of them is that there was this Mongol Empire, these Asians from northern China, that in less than a generation created a war machine like the universe has never seen, literally out of nothing, and swept everything away before it, from, you know, almost to Japan, not quite, almost to Japan, up front to Poland, and everything in between. At the time, I didn't realize that very few actual Russians in Russia believe this. It's a ridiculous thesis. I mean, the more I think about it, the more ridiculous it seems. How is this even remotely, how could a sparsely populated area in less than a generation create a war machine capable of fielding hundreds of thousands of men, each one with three horses? You would need a massive economy. You would need a substantial division of labor. You would need a highly populated. I mean, it just can't be done. It's a myth. There hasn't been a single Asian skeleton from the so-called Mongol era unearthed in Russia. I've read everything there is to read, at least in terms of the primary sources, in the Mongol era. No one ever says that they look different, sound different, or from Asia, in the sense that we would use the term. If they were Asians, like in the sense we use the word Chinese or Japanese, they would have noticed and said they look different from us. No one mentions that. No one says it. No one ever says that we needed translators. No one ever says these aren't foreigners. These may be nasty people. They're pagans. They've destroyed our cities, et cetera, et cetera. But they're not foreigners. Oh, sorry, let me put it this way. They're foreigners, but they're not aliens. They talk like us. They look like us. if you go to contemporary paintings of that era, battle scenes between Mongols and Rus, they look exactly alike. And yet the very same, if they depict Turks, they're two very different groups of people and how they're depicted. You can't tell the difference between Mongol and Rus in the early paintings. That's because they're the same people, speaking the same or very similar language. Who were the people that then took over? Well, he's talking, you know, 14, Russia had about 200 cities in, you know, 1250. They took over 14 of them. Usually with the full cooperation of the population. And they weren't all pagans. I mean, initially, you know, they were so frightening. And I gave a whole lecture on this and why that's absurd. You can't believe in the Mongol myth and all this. And with the Tartar, Cossacks used to be called Tartars in the 18th century. The word Mongol has nothing to do with someone from Mongolia. Mongol is just someone who's great in the Greek language, a megalo. Someone who is powerful. Contemporary sources say that the Mongols were white men. Both Tamerlane and Genghis Khan had red hair. You can go from, you know, over and over again. Contemporary writers, Rashid al-Din, for example, who talks about Genghis Khan as having blue eyes, or gray eyes, he said. Certainly not Asian. Now, as you get older, you know, 18th century, 19th century, all of a sudden the Mongols start looking Asian. But they weren't to begin with. So who the heck were they? They were Scythians. They were a Slavic people who, 6th, 7th century AD, had a substantial, highly urbanized empire in Siberia. They were powerful at the Chinese court. They were Russians. Mongols were Aryan people. They were Scythian people. When we use the word Scythian, we mean it in a very broad sense. We're including, you know, Avars. We're including Sarmatians. You know, very similar, what Gulenev would call complementary people. And one displaced another without a real civilizational change. The first time we hear lots of Scythian or Russian names at the Chinese court, you have about around 1340. The Avar Kagan, 6th, 7th century, appeared on the Danube after being pushed around by the Huns and took all of North Italy. These were Slavic-speaking people. Anna Comnenus or Constantine Porphyrogenitus, they equate Rus, Slav, Avar, Scythian, all they used interchangeably. Leo the Deacon the same way. Scythia equals Russia. And the concept of the Kagan, now, you know, Jews have taken that name, Kaganovich, the ruler of Khazaria. Even there, you have Hajin, a very similar version, found in the Baltics, in the Baltic states. In a very brief period of time, these so-called Mongols became Orthodox. And there was a failed crusade. It was a 13th century papal crusade against Russia, failed according to the papacy due to the Mongols. The Mongols invaded Europe in alliance with Frederick II. They defeated the Lombard papal forces. This was certainly a Russian, if not entirely Orthodox, movement. And all of the ancient authorities refer, I mean, Marco Polo refers to the Scythian civilization, the tremendous urbanization there. What decimated the horde was Islam. That radical religious difference tore them to pieces. The direct descendants of the so-called Mongols are Cossacks. That shouldn't surprise you, because when you read descriptions of what the Mongols were, you're reading about what a Cossack is. They dressed very similarly. They're identical people, because they are the same people. We're talking about the origin of Great Tartary. In the British Encyclopedia, Great Tartary is this huge empire in Northern Asia, what we call the Slav Avar Empire of Siberia. Now, the Sarmatian invasion, whatever came later, Scythia proper was reduced to just Crimea. But it doesn't take away the fact that you had this huge empire that was in fact capable of fielding a war machine that the contemporaries of the day say the Mongols were. Now, we can't, there's no way to change the name. You know, we can't not call them Mongols anymore. Scythian is going to be weird. We have to understand Mongols have nothing to do with Mongolia, the country of Mongolia. I mean, they were connected, but not racially speaking. It's very clear what language they spoke, and all the contemporary authorities say that it was an Aryan language and what we would call today a Proto-Slavic language. They functioned and lived as we would consider the Cossacks to live today. There's no example of negotiating. You know, you read the stories of these guys, you know, Orthodox saints being killed by some of the pagan military units of that army. No one ever talks about a translator. They all know each other. The odd thing, even when I first started in this field, the weird thing about the Mongols, the Mongol occupation, was how enthusiastic many aspects, especially the Muscovites, were in carrying out their orders. It was one unit. And besides that, there are tremendous benefits to the church, which, you know, had a renaissance in that era, thanks to this Scythian military occupation. Agumilev reminds us that names like Itomuchin, Bati, Berg, Mamai, these are initially Proto-Slavic. These are Scythian names. There are no Mongols named Bati or Mamai today. The best way to put it, that the Tartar yoke is the Scythian military control of Russia. Consider a huge Cossack horde that conquered some of the southern Russian cities and extracted tribute, no different than Moscow would do later. So all the garbage that anti-Russian writers, that this is a non-white people, yeah, they've been blown away by the fact that there's no Asian artifacts from any occupation force ever in Russia. No Asian skeletons. No skeletons that you could say this is a Chinaman. This is someone from, we would call today, Mongolia. But when Marco Polo observed the Slavic Khaganate of Kamblik, which is one of the, Scythian units in southern Siberia, they had paved roads, they had a strong infrastructure, they had 200 cities. Well, when you read about what the Mongol Empire did, you would need at least that. You would have to have a substantial economy. Now, one of the things that Tamerlane did is he burnt the Moscow Library to the ground. I don't know how far we could push this. But Peter the Great, and before him, Alexis, and they wanted to destroy, and for very good reasons, the power of the local clans, the aristocratic boyar clans that had their own private armies, navies, intelligence services, even currencies. They took their family histories, which were multi-volume, and burned them. The problem with that is that the history of Russia was there. You see, these families would point to this history as they're competing with each other for political power, that we've done more for Russia than you, so we deserve this, we're older than you, whatever. And they would make reference to these histories. Well, both Alexis and Peter hunted every page of that down and burnt it. So many of the records are gone from that era for this reason, and the fact that the Scythians torched the substantial libraries that existed in Moscow at the time. So we have this black spot on world history, which is Great Tartary. The Cumans would be the heirs to the Sarmatian civilization. These aren't nomads, you know. And so Gumilev would say the Great Scythia is a super ethnos of Russia. So you would include their Cimmerians, Sarmatians, Roxanians, all the same. The tradition is that Homer, the Cimmerian, the oldest son of Japheth, the son of Noah. Now, one of the ways that they can be identified is first of all, excellent metalwork and the burial mound catacomb system. So the very simple way to understand it is that, you know, roughly 1000 BC, the steppe is under Scythian control. This is this huge area from northern China all the way to the Middle East, the Caucasus Mountains, I should say. And between 800 and 400 BC was the very height of their empire. Gumilev talks about how the Sarmatians, you know, removed them from power, but these were complementary groups. They're both proto-Slavic organizations. And ultimately based in what we would call modern-day Ukraine, in southern European Russia, and the Crimea. They defeated Darius I of Persia. Great Scythia and this empire, Great Tartary, whatever you want to call it, established its control over the Silk Road. This huge, vast trading network that connected Greece, Persia, China, India, and really contributed to the material development of these civilizations. Wherever the Scythians go, you see a very distinct form of metalwork that very few other people can match. And it's very distinctive. And the Scythians are everywhere. There's records of them fighting the Egyptians. There were this long, when you had a substantial material basis like that, you can get away with it. You can't do what the Mongols later did without a civilization like that. In fact, the sack of Nineveh, 612 BC, this was the Scythians, as they lost control over Media. They were absolutely everywhere, and they were very dominant in China. The Indo-Scythians were this group that migrated into South Asia. I guess around third century AD, the Han Dynasty in China is waning, and the Zhanggu, which is the Eastern Scythians, crossed the mountains, and they ultimately settled in the Tarim Basin. And then you have two area languages, the Khotanese languages. And the Brahmi scriptures from the 10th and 11th centuries AD. This is the same group of people. Gumilev would call this a sub-ethnos. I mean, they were independent units. but they're part of a much larger entity, and their identity comes from this much larger entity. The kingdom of Khotan was conquered by the Kara Khanate, which led to the domination of Islam, the Turkification of what we, you know, northwestern China. Now you have a breakup of the system. You know, Scythians and Sarmatians were, you know, by the early Middle Ages were absorbed, and became, of course, Slavs. But long before then, the steppe was already a major exporter of grain. This is the heart of the world here. There's nothing more strategic than the Eurasian Plain. It connects everybody. You have scholars like P.N. Schultz who say that Scythia and Rus are identical in terms of their material culture. Great Tartary is what the Mongol is. You see the swastika everywhere in that pattern. So many of the older patterns, geometrically speaking, we still see today in certain parts of Ukraine. So I guess, and then the next step, of course, is the Sarmatians. I guess they, you know, by the first century AD, they range from, I guess, the Vistula River, you know, to the mouth of the Danube, all the way to the Volga, and all the way to the shores of the Black Sea and Caspian. You know, that territory known as Sarmatia, and this is how the Greco-Roman intellectuals viewed it at the time. This would be the western part of Great Scythia, southern Russia. The first century AD, they make their first substantial military contact with Rome, and they are, although very different, have an alliance with the Germans. And the only thing that broke their dominance of Pontia was the Goths. The Germanic Goths were able to finally dislodge them. Now, when the Huns came in the 4th century, the Sarmatians then joined the Goths and some of the Germanic tribes like the Vandals, and they settled in the Western Roman Empire. Just like everyone else, the Sarmatians assimilated by the Slavs and became Slavs. The Sarmatians are white, absolutely Caucasoid in appearance, very light skin and light hair, very tall. The skeletons that we found average maybe 5'10", which is very, very odd for the era. Long hair, beard, lots of, in the great Greek doctor, physician Galen, said that reddish hair is one of their dominant traits. One of the Sarmatian subethnoses, the Alans or the Alani, Marcellinus, the great Roman historian, says this: nearly all of the Alani are men of great stature and beauty. Their hair is somewhat yellow. Their eyes are frighteningly fierce. This Alani migrated to the south and became more or less the country of Georgia. So that's a very long way of explaining who the Mongols were. That's why we call them Tartars. I went through all this before, but you know, I'm almost embarrassed now that I fell for it. It was such a stupid concept, but I accepted it because everyone else did. You know, and to this day, the notion that the Mongol Empire was an Asian has not penetrated the U.S., and yet very few Russians believe it. No Mongols believe it. Where are all of the artifacts? You would think that you would have Asian artifacts all over the place in the headquarters of the Golden Horde in Sarai. There's nothing. There's nothing. We have a tendency, because we, you know, early on, I was young and I still was, you know, accepted the mainstream view. My Russian wasn't as great back then. It's not great now, but it was, I was still struggling back then. I didn't challenge the notion. That means when I read, see some of the great saints that spoke of the Mongol invasion, I simply imposed the traditional view onto what I'm reading. And so it was a matter of confirmation bias at that point. Now let me wind up here on Khazaria, because everyone loves to talk about Khazaria. There was an attempt in the Soviet era to ban, or at least to highly limit, research into the Khazar Empire. Gumilev is, as I said before, one of the great authorities in the 20th century in the Khazar Empire. And Gumilev is, he was a Russian Orthodox nationalist, of course. But, and that's why he was spent a good chunk of his life in prison in the Soviet Union. Yet his talent was such that no one could deny it. The central thing that Gumilev will say about the Jews is that this is the only group of people who took the search for profit, financial profit, and made it into a national idea. He calls Khazaria a chimera. We talked about this the last time. A chimera is where you have the meeting of two ethnic groups. You have one gradually over time destroying the founding stock of the other. Immigration is the way to do this. The nomad, the Jews are certainly nomads, and the initial Khazars were. The nomads are not to be romanticized. They have no morality because they have no connection to any place. They have nothing to lose. They have no attachments. They have no stable tradition, in Gumilev's view. But Khazaria was settled, but initially you have a Turkic population. Jews came to Khazaria in two ways. The first, and this is a totally separate issue, the refugees from the war in the Persian Empire, based on the what could only be called a proto-Bolshevik Mazdak movement. The war that exploded in Persia. I could probably do a whole show on this guy. I mean, you had a movement in the early, what we would call the early Middle Ages. A priestly leader, the Zoroastrian named Mazdak. He created this ideology, largely coming from some very, very, Gnostic conceptions of Christianity. Everyone is equal. Everyone has equal right to everything. And private property, including personal property, is out of the question. They took for themselves the universal negation fire. It was burning and destruction. Ultimately, what it came down to was they loved the idea of the community of wives. So whenever these guys came around, you had to lock up the daughters. This was a purely, almost a completely atheistic, really it was a Bolshevik movement. It was based on, it was heavily Judaic. It was based on a tightly knit party organization. Absolute fanatical fighters. With absolutely no morality whatsoever. They called their central headquarters the Temple of Fire and Freedom and Common Ownership. And of course, that's where women were taken as their communal property. And as things were unstable in Persia, the monarchy had to listen to this group of people. And wherever this group went, followers of Mazdak, any kind of barbarism was sanctioned. The mob ruled. But this group of people reduced everything to just this desire for equality of women. We could take whatever woman we want. Morality, religion were renounced. The party became a law unto itself. This was a movement of Mazdak. But the civil war that caused in Persia led to a movement of Jews into Khazaria. These were mostly Karaites at the time. These were both good and bad. Karaites are, I have no problem with Karaites. They're decent people. The second, though, in the 9th century, a bit later, came both from Iran and Byzantium. This was the Talmudic movement. This second group is what took over. When Obadiah seized power, he placed Talmudic rabbis in every position of power imaginable. This is where the Chimera comes in. The first thing he did was destroy Christianity within the empire, because Khazaria initially, there was at least one Byzantine bishop, and Christianity was growing. And one of the first things that the Talmud, the Karaites usually don't do stuff like this, but the, you know, when the medieval writers, including patristic writers, when they make reference to Jews, remember, they're not referencing Samaritans or Karaites. A Karaite is a Jew, what most of the idiots think a Jew is. They accept the Old Testament, the Torah, and that's it. What most people don't know is that during the Spanish Inquisition and before then, the Talmudists went on a rampage and killed these people wherever they could be found. There's very few Karaites left. The few that can be found, I think they've been wiped out in Spain, but it's largely in the Caucasus Mountains. And that first wave of Jewish migration were largely Karaites, probably innocent, from the also Judaic Mazdak movement there. Later on, you had this Byzantine and then, you know, Central Asian immigration when Byzantium threw them out. The Black Sea was, and the Aral Sea was, I'm sorry, the Caspian Sea was a place to go. And the first thing that these Talmudists did when they took over is destroy Christianity. Gumilev says that they created the notion of total war. And we mentioned this already. There's two different concepts here. In the American sense, when you say total war, it means when the federal government takes over the entire economy and every aspect of American life is based on warfare. The war we have going on right now requires, what, you know, 2% of the American productivity. Now, World War II, 100% American productivity. The state simply took over. But when Gumilev says the Khazar Jews created the idea of total war, what they meant was the slaughter of the population. And we don't mean, you know, if people are sacrificing babies, so we're going to kill them, like in the Old Testament. No, this is slaughter. This is, you know, putting salt in the ground. This is annihilating entire groups of people. Now, when Khazaria was smashed, new Khazaria was founded in Spain. And yet you did have many stragglers, of course, who went to Kiev and monopolized the trading and usury there. I have an article on my website about the anti-Jewish riots and in 1114. But just like the nomad, Gumilev says that the Jewish culture, such as it is, you know, they use people because they're being nomadic, they have no attachment, and they don't know what it's like for any long-term attachment. They have no long-term attachment to the terrain in the broad sense. They have no concept of that kind of sentimentality. They're radically xenophobic. It's an in-group, inbred movement. Another thing that Gumilev says, and you know, writers like Vadim Kozhinov say that Russia, as an idea, Russia and Ukraine as a moral and religious idea, has its root in the confrontation of Kiev with the Khazar Empire. In fact, they'll say that, or at least Kozhinov will say, that the Khazar yoke was far more significant than the Tatar yoke, because it was thousands of Russians were enslaved, and they had to pay a tremendous tribute. They didn't produce anything, of course. They just blocked the Volga trade. So as early as the 5th century in Persia, we're talking about pure Bolshevism. And Mazdak, the Mazdak movement, this was slowly but surely the groups that became part of Khazaria. Not necessarily that this movement moved to Khazaria. Most of them were wiped out. But based on this civil war, and then, of course, the removal of Jews from Byzantium, Khazaria was the place to go. And it was universal negation. And that became, you read Karl Marx's early poetry, you see the same thing. Anyway, I'm over my time. I'd like to go into the Mazdak movement in more detail. But this is where Khazaria is from. We've completed the very complicated system, I think, of Lev Gumilev's history of civilization. What civilization is, what a culture is. And I ask you to support my work, as always. My website, rusjournal.org. Please donate to me. I'll send you my new Russia book if you do. Email me if you need. Thank you, Savannah, as always, for all the work you do. And I'll talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioAryan.com.